Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we'll start with a newspaper editor's reaction to the beheadings of two journalists. The Globe's Brian McGorry joins us. Then medical ethicist Art Kaplan weighs in on Medicare funding end-of-life consultations by doctors. Does anyone have Sarah Palin's cell number? And on a new app which lets you summon a doctor for a house call. Then we'll ask you about that app. Would you use it? And will it create yet a further divide between the medical haves and have-nots?
Homeland Security expert Juliette Kayyem joins us on continued atrocities by ISIS, a lack of diversity in local police departments, and a celebration of kids returning to school. Then, continuing our interviews with the gubernatorial candidates prior to Tuesday's primary, State Treasurer Steve Grossman visits Studio 3. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Hello, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. Joining us on the phone, as he does every Wednesday to start things off today, is the editor of the Boston Globe. Good afternoon, Brian McGorry.
Hello, Jim Browdy. Hello, Marjorie Egan. How are you?
I'm great, Brian McGorry. Starting on a tough note here, but it is horrible news. The Islamic State in Iraq and Syria has now beheaded a second American journalist, Stephen Sotloff. James Foley, of course, was killed by them earlier. You know, Brian, you are the editor of a major newspaper, and you got to think a lot about these things, sending reporters over to war zones like these. We've talked to one of your former colleagues, Charlie Stennett, Global Post, all the time about this. He was very close with James Foley. What's your thinking about this? How do you make these decisions about sending reporters to these places where they're in such terrible danger for their lives?
Well, I appreciate that, Marjorie. First of all, this is it's truly an unimaginable situation we have here with Stephen Sotloff and James Foley's gruesome deaths. And you know, you mentioned Charlie Stennett. Charlie was a very acclaimed, deservedly so, foreign correspondent here in many war zones for many years. And he left here to found Global Post. And the reason Global Post is such a critical, pivotal organization is that papers like the Globe have cut way back on our foreign coverage. Major metro papers all around the country have decided that we can no longer afford to cover the world in the way we used to. At its peak, the Globe used to have eight foreign bureaus. We had two reporters in Baghdad at one point and another reporter in Jerusalem. And other papers have done the exact same thing we have, including major papers like the Washington Post, which have cut way back on its foreign coverage. And that has opened up an avenue for Global Post to provide foreign news to major news organizations in a way that we didn't need before. And that has then led to correspondents like James Foley being in very dangerous situations. So my heart goes out to obviously the Foley family, but to Charlie as well, who has spent no small amount of time training people like James Foley in the dangers. And you know, I'll also mention Phil Balboni as well, who's done extraordinary work, co-founder of Global Post, and making sure that their correspondents are in safe situations. But some of these things are just not preventable.
Well, Brian, does there come a point where you have to say we can't send people there anymore?
Well, yes, and I think we have seen situations where that's happened, where some of these situations are just too dangerous to go into. But you know, before that happens, it's imperative to make sure that these correspondents are fully trained in basically self-preservation, in how to avoid the most dangerous situations. You know, Global Post has done decent, good work at doing that, but sometimes, you know, the reality is some of these freelancers are younger and not quite as experienced in these situations as maybe it was 10, 15, 20 years ago. And other times they are trained in these situations, but there's just very little they can do.
You know, I am continue to be stunned, as I have been for years, by both the courage and commitment of people like Foley and Sotloff. And I've said this to Charlie Stennett many a time, both on and off the air. I just can't believe that he made the decision to repeatedly go into places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Palestinian territory. Did it most of it for the Boston Globe. When you were a reporter, did you ever think about these kinds of things for yourself, Brian McGorry?
I mean, I was never put in a situation like this. I was never asked to go cover a war, and, you know, tell you the truth, I never sought it out for reasons that I was mostly covering politics. I was in Washington. I did consider at one point going to cover Russia to be our Moscow correspondent, and I ended up deciding not to do that. But it never came down to a decision for me. There are many people in this newsroom who did cover the war in Iraq and did it very, very well. But yeah, you bring up a great point, Jim. The courage of these people is almost mind-bending. What they're willing to go through to get the story, to get. The views of the people with Stephen Sotloff, seeing him interviewing people in Benghazi at a time of great stress after Muammar Gaddafi had fallen, to be, you know, in Syria, in Iraq. It's these are really, really dangerous, difficult situations.
Brian McGorry from the Boston Globe. A few years ago, when Daniel Pearl became one of the first journalists that was beheaded in a gruesome way, as these two later journalists, Stephen Sotloff and James Foley, have been, the Boston Phoenix actually ran the video, took a lot of flack for it. And these videos of these latest two beheadings have been available online, at least briefly. But people, news organizations have, for the most part, not run them. Why not?
It's a great question, and we've you know, debated it a little bit here, but we all pretty much come down on the same side, and that is the videos are easily accessible by anybody who wants to see them online. All you have to do is go to YouTube. You can punch them up and see them. We've made the decision we don't want to put them on our site because it's basically what the terrorists, what the murderers want us to do. They want us to see this the situation. These killings live, and we don't think that's appropriate. We certainly are not looking to censor anything here. We know that people can access them. We're just not condoning the viewing of them by putting them online.
One last thing. I think it was Jeff Jacoby, one of the columnists of the Globe, that said people should watch this. I think it was after the Foley execution. Have you ever watched one of these things, Brian?
So here's I don't know what you guys have done, and I've wrestled with it tremendously. I have watched the Foley video multiple times right up to the point of the killing, and I had to stop there. I just did not want to see it.
Me too. We're talking to Brian McGorry from the Boston Globe. This is a very hard segue to go from something that like this to politics, but we are, whatever, 5 days away from, is it 5 days? 6 days away from a primary. You used to be a columnist in your former life.
Was I?
You were. I know you're not in charge.
Was I any good?
There were stories.
Brian.
That 42,
it's hard to remember.
That 42-part series you did on Liberty Mutual was really one of the finest year-long things I've ever seen.
Wait a minute. We must share the best detail of that.
What's
at
that?
Least in my opinion, was the heated. What do they have? Heated floors and the airplane hangars, Brian.
They did have a heated tarmac.
Couldn't believe
why
that.
Why wouldn't they?
Heated tarmac.
Okay, fine. So, but the question I'm asking, with X number of days to go, and I'm still agonizing over the fact that this primary is coming up so quickly after the summer. Very little attention, I think, until hopefully the last week of this thing. Do editorials and columnists endorsing candidates, do they matter anymore?
I actually think it does, especially among primary voters. Primary voters are, you know, the most hardened voters are the ones that are keyed in the closest to these races. They're often the ones, for every obvious reason, with the strongest party affiliation, and they are paying attention to what quote-unquote influencers are thinking. And look, and I'm not saying that it can turn an election, but I am saying that the endorsements, especially enough of them and important endorsements, do matter and can create momentum for candidates.
So based on reading the Boston Globe, obviously you're voting for Steve Grossman for governor?
Well, I mean, look, that's the editorial page offered what I thought was a really thoughtful and provocative endorsement.
Not to mention Shirley Leung in this morning's paper,
yeah.
By the way.
Shirley,
and her column to you.
Shirley had been planning this column for quite a while. I thought it was another terrific column by Shirley. And, you know, she outlined a lot of really really good reasons for voting for Grossman. You know, that said, look, you know that the news pages are independent from the editorial pages. We are in the middle of running three candidate profiles right now this week. Today was Don Berwick. I thought it was a very strong profile.
It was.
Very compelling. And over the next 2 days, we'll have Martha Coakley and Steve Grossman.
I think these are big deals, especially for people who don't pay a lot of attention.
Well, especially in the lower races, yes, where people don't even know who the candidates are.
Did you see that front page story that Akilah Johnson had yesterday?
Oh, yes.
Nobody knew the names, yes, of anybody running for anything under the Attorney General's office.
Well, exactly. And you give a – have this, not you, because you're separate from the editorial page, but the Marianne Ryan for Middlesex District Attorney. I mean, a lot of people are not paying attention to who's running for district attorney. And, you know, you're the Boston Globe. You're not a small paper. But in towns, I mean, I don't know what I would do without the local Brookline tab telling me the pros and cons of people on the local level, because most of us are not paying attention.
Yeah, it's exactly right, and that's why I do think they matter a little bit more in the primary, because by the time you get to the general election, there's also more attention being paid, and people can, you know, draw a little bit more of their own opinion.
Let me say, I would have been elected to the Cambridge City Council even had I not been endorsed by the Cambridge Chronicle. I've done a lot of research. No, really, I've done some research. I don't want to get
really
into it, but yeah, I would have.
Yeah.
On a much more serious note, we didn't talk to you last week, and I really wanted to. Jenna Russell did a three-part series focusing on mental illness, and one particular mother and son, and the struggles that they both went through, and particularly, at least from my perspective, focusing on the lifelong commitment and fight of this mother to get adequate care for her teenager, come 20, come 30-something. I thought it was as powerful a picture of what families have to deal with mental illness in a time of short resources of anything I've ever read, Brian.
Thank you for that. Jenna Russell did, for my money, some of the most important work we'll do here at the Globe this year with a three-part series on Mike Bourne and his mother, Peggy. She embedded herself with the family for close to a year and a half.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And they gave her virtually full access to, you know, the monumental problems that Mike faced and that Peggy faced, the small triumphs they had along the way, the heartbreak, the anguish, the difficulties dealing with an incredibly complex system. And for my money, it was a brilliant piece of work that just showed what it means to be mentally ill in the society, in the uphill climb in getting the proper care, not only for the patient, but for the family. And then, look, for the neighbors.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you mentioned,
yes,
that. For the neighbor who has,
yes,
across the street somebody who they're troubled by because he screams at night or because he's out on the street without a shirt. I mean, that is a really important contribution, I think, to those who don't have mental illness, at least that they're aware of in their own families. Other was huge.
Did you also catch the in the series a part about the police chief?
Yes.
In the steps he took in
sitting down,
coming over and playing the guitar, and it was really quite extraordinary.
Well, you know what I thought was, you know, sometimes there are stories that you see in the paper that everybody can relate to,
everybody,
because they have had to a lesser or greater degree some kind of problem like this. I mean, mental health issues are huge, particularly among young people, teenagers and stuff like that. And this was a roadmap of what they went through trying to get care for their kids. And you always think when you turn around and hear these terrible stories about a mentally ill person committing a crime, it's almost like, why doesn't this happen every day? Because the struggle to get mental health care is like banging your head against the wall over and over and over again. And why are we surprised when we fail these people and fail their families and fail the neighborhoods that someone acts out? You know what I mean?
It's exactly right, Marjorie. It's exactly right. And we heard from so many people who wrote in, called, saying it was as if you wrote the series about us. But you don't hear a lot about mental illness because it's one of these diseases that people tend not to talk about. But when we did, when Jenna Russell did it with the empathy that she had, you could really sense that people really felt connected to it because of their own experiences.
Can we do a short sidebar on this? Really a short thing. Oh, Marjorie, you have it. You want to broach
the
top?
The backstory here about Judge Jeffrey Locke actually ruled in favor of the Boston Globe when Steward Healthcare wanted to review the reporting and the records collected by the Globe for the public, for the article. It, at that point, hadn't even been published yet. You called this a thinly veiled intimidation tactic against a former patient. Tell people about what Steward Healthcare did.
Well, I look.
Or not.
The funny part is there was no reason for them to do anything that they did. They were barely referenced in the story. I think in the first version of the story before they decided to sue us and take us to court, I don't think the word steward was in the story. They got all nervous about what we were going to write. They felt that they didn't have the opportunity because of HIPAA regulations, HIPAA rules, that they could not respond to anything that Mike Bourne was telling us, even though we understood that. So we had already made the decision to make the story as fair as humanly possible. It wasn't about Stewart, but they sued us. They sent a constable to Mike Bourne's house as day turned into night. A guy in an official-looking uniform presented him with very official-looking court papers. I said what I said in the paper about it being unconscionable to do that to a mentally ill patient. And we went to court, and for the most part, the judge ruled with us that, of course, Steward wasn't able to see our notes and see whatever it was we had before we published the story.
One last thing on this, Brian. I read every word of this long three-part series, and I was stunned because I had read about the litigation before, their attempt to get some prior restraint here. I didn't see the word Steward. Was that taken out because of the litigation, or was never in the story to begin with?
No, it was never in the story to begin with, but it was put in the final version, I thought.
Oh, I didn't see it. Okay.
Yeah.
Brian, one last thing about some...
Let me make that really clear, Jim. We did not change a comma, a line,
That's
a paragraph of this story because of Steward's attempts to try to take us to court. We
Thanks
did not
for the clarification. Got it.
So let's move on to kind of a fun story here. The Times of London is using typewriters, the sounds of click, 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 to inspire journalists at Deadline to get with the program and work harder. Rupert Murdoch owns the Times of London. But, you know, some of us, and I think you're in that group, Brian, can remember that sound before we had computers in the newsroom of the typewriters around 5 o'clock in the afternoon and the cigarette smoke as well, sometimes the cigar smoke at my old newspaper, the Boston Herald. The typewriter's going like crazy. Did you think they made you work harder because you heard those typewriters all the time, click, click, clicking?
So I came into the business in the middle of the transition from typewriters to word processors. Do you remember when you'd go on the road, Marjorie, with a Radio Shack, what was it called, a Trash 80?
Trash 80.
And you'd have those couplers that you put on a payphone to transmit your story?
I'd end up having to dictate it, Brian. I could never get the damn thing to work. You know, I'd be out there in Okie from a Skokie someplace and just have to call in on a payphone.
Like if a car drove by anywhere within a half a mile, the couplers were thrown off and
exactly.
You couldn't transmit the story.
Exactly.
So I came in just as we were going from typewriters to computers. So I never sat in a newsroom that was filled with the sound of typewriters. And I mean, it's got to be the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard, what they're doing over there. It's romance at a time when we should be looking forward, not back.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm very susceptible to these things. I think it would make me very nervous and sit down at my desk. I remember when Elliot, remember Elliot Norton, who was a famous film critic and theater critic, much more than a film critic, I should say, theater critic and music critic. He worked for years. He worked at all the incarnations of the different Boston newspapers. Anyway, he retired. And when he retired, we all swooped down around his typewriter because he had a really nice typewriter where all the letters work. Because my typewriter, guess what letters didn't work? T and the period. So you were trying to write stories. How many times did you say the in a story? Probably 1,000 times. Sure. So you were having to write stories and write in on that triplicate paper the T in your own little pen or pencil and the period. Because, you know, we all had typewriters then. And I do remember that, but maybe I'm just too...
I'm a lot younger than both of you. I don't remember the typewriter. Hey, we're talking to Brian McGorry, who's the editor of the Boston Globe. This morning, I went online to a website, CruxNow, CruxNow.com, and I got to read a column, a terrific column, I should say, by the spirituality columnist.
Why, thank you, Jim.
That would be Marjorie Egan. Congratulations on launching of this thing. And what is it, for those who don't know, Brian McGorry?
Well, thank you for bringing this up, Jim. And Marjorie, huge, huge congratulations to you for your debut column today.
Oh, thank you. It's so much fun. I'm having such a blast.
So Crux is our new website by the Boston Globe Media Partners, a website that is devoted solely to Catholicism across the nation and truly around the globe. And we've hired an all-star cast of editors and reporters and correspondents here and in Rome. To cover Catholicism, Marjorie made her brilliant debut as our spirituality columnist. It could not have been more perfect. Nobody started that column and didn't finish it. You outlined beautifully what you plan to do in the future, but you also outlined why it is that for so many Catholics, the faith persists amid so much controversy. And it was a really, really well-done column that we have right at the top of the Crux homepage now. And it's been one of the most read, if not the most read, piece of work on the site all day. And we are delighted to have it and delighted to see what you're going to do next.
My goodness. Why doesn't Jim Browdy ever tell me something like that?
I texted this morning. I thought it was great. And by the way, the title of the piece, which really describes what we Catholics give up too soon, it's a terrific piece. And I have to say, as a non-Catholic, and I assumed I would have zero interest other than in Marjorie, in this website, I it's terrific, and it really fills a hole. And I have to say, when I first heard about this, long before the Marjorie connection, I don't know, from you or read it in the paper or something, I said this is a ridiculous idea. The audience isn't there. It is at least so far. It's a terrific concept, and I think it has potentially real broad appeal. Brian,
thank you, Jim, very much for that. So the goal of the site was to make it a serious site, but also an accessible site, to not be overbearing. Even as we take on very heady issues in the Catholic Church. And I think when you go on this site, it looks inviting. It feels inviting. Yeah. There's all sorts of material there that you want to read, and it's being updated constantly. Teresa Hanifin is the editor. She is off to a terrific start. John Allen had a world-class column yesterday on questions that we're not asking of the Pope because of his incredible popularity, and we couldn't feel better about this right now.
By the way, it's no ChristianMingle.com, but it is good.
What? You know, it's great that there's an advice columnist here,
Lisa Miller, who's an unbelievably
fantastic journalist, written a million stories about religion and stuff like that. Oh my God, is her column
OMG?
OMG, exactly. And giving advice. I think the person came upon her colleague that was having an affair and what to do about that. I mean, it's just fantastic.
It is. By the way, it's Crux, CruxNow.com. Okay, Brian, the time has come. We haven't spoken to you in quite a bit because
it's been a long time.
Apparently, you've been on vacation or something. But last time that we spoke to you, which was pretty much a month ago, here is the commitment that you made to us at the end of the conversation. Here it is.
Obviously, there have been a couple of tiny bumps in terms of me getting the answer to you.
Okay.
But it's inconceivable that there would be anything else that would get in the way.
Fine.
Okay.
So next week it's a given.
That's D-Day.
Next week.
Now, next week was 4 weeks ago, and obviously, and it's not all your fault. But the good news is you had a month to deal with this. And for those who are not aware of what we're talking about, the terrific Friday section that I am obsessed with, it's called Capital, C-A-P-I-T-A-L, about politics and that sort of thing. The debate that's going on throughout the city and the region is why it has an A in it rather than an O. Brian sort of obfuscated when we broached the topic with him maybe 7 or 8 weeks ago, but said, as you just heard, that we would finally have an answer. So can we finally put this thing to rest, please? Brian McGorry, go ahead.
Well, Jim, first of all, I am deeply, deeply resentful, angry that you would ever imply in any way at all that I quote-unquote obfuscated.
Maybe that was a bit strong, but it is the way I feel. I'm sorry.
A bit strong. I find that accusation emotionally draining, such that I had an answer ready to give you today, and I truly don't think I can find it within myself to offer somebody who's coming at me as strongly as you are that answer today.
Well, okay, the way you're saying it, only to get this over with, even though I have nothing to apologize for, I apologize. I shouldn't have used the word obfuscate. Maybe I should have said it was unbecoming that you promised this to us a couple of months ago. Okay, I apologize. Let's have it.
Some apologies just come too late. And this, I believe, falls firmly in that category. So what I would suggest is you take a week to think about what you said to me. And why don't we revisit this next week when I'll give you the answer that I already have in my hand.
Oh, it's in your hand?
It's in my hand.
Okay, then fine.
That's
okay,
right,
fine. Yeah,
that's right. You got to wait, Jim.
Okay,
that's
fine. One more week.
One more week.
Brian,
yes.
It's been a pleasure.
Has it, Jim.
Good to speak to you, Brian McGrory.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much. Marjorie, congratulations
to
you.
Oh, thank you very much, Brian. Made me feel really good. Thank you. He is Brian McGrory. He is the editor of the Boston Globe, and he joins us every Wednesday. Coming up, deaf panels get a makeover. The NIH gears up for clinical trials on an Ebola vaccine, and going electric could be the key to improving our memory. Medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us for that discussion next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. In 2009, when healthcare reform was hotly debated, the wall-to-wall coverage was lined with death panels. That was a catchphrase that Sarah Palin engineered to describe her proposal to pay doctors to talk to patients about end-of-life care.
It's in black and white in the law that there will be rationing of health care. They couldn't go forever in not acknowledging that, or they would look like complete buffoons, and they would be deemed incompetent, having not read the law to understand that death panels are a part of this atrocity.
Well, I'll say nothing about that, except to say that according to Alaska's governor, what she would call death panels are alive and well. They're making a comeback, apparently, if the American Medical Association has its way. Medicare might begin covering these end-of-life discussions. Joining us to take on this and other medical headlines is Art Kaplan. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hey there, Art.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, great, Art Kaplan. So we read in the Times a couple of days ago that not only are Medicare and Medicaid possibly going to be doing this, but private insurers have already begun reimbursing doctors for these advanced care planning conversations, as they call them. So what do you think of this?
I think it's great, overdue. It was ridiculous to make it a political issue because what we're talking about here is having a discussion about what you would want if you couldn't communicate your wishes to your doctors. And that happens all the time. I have to deal with it all the time in my job here at NYU. And you really want to have what I call the discussion. You want people to know whether you would like aggressive care. You'd like people to know whether you want everything possible, whether you want people to back off. Sarah Palin sort of equated this with a you're going to have to leave us now to save society money discussion. But there's nothing to stop you from saying, give me everything, I want everything, try everything, spend the college fund out, take every cent you've got out of the mortgage and spend it on me. You could. You certainly could.
I understand about the private insurer thing. Obviously, unilaterally, they can do what they will. How does Medicare do this? What is it, the Office of Medicaid and Medicare? We had Don Berwick in here yesterday, the former head of it under Barack Obama. Can they do it unilaterally? Do they need congressional approval?
They don't need congressional approval. They can do it unilaterally, but they risk congressional ire, and there are political consequences. So at the time the proposal was first made to pay doctors for the time involved in the discussion of these issues, which probably takes, 25, 35 minutes to do it well, Obama feared it and his team feared it because of the political reverberations getting associated with death discussions, and they just pulled it off the table. But CMS, as it's called, the outfit that runs Medicare and Medicaid, they could do it. They can do it on their own.
You know, the one good piece of news for people who think this is totally sane and important is Tom Coburn, who's a United States Senator from Oklahoma, Republican, very conservative, and a doctor, has actually filed a bipartisan bill that would do this. When you said it takes about 25 or 30 minutes, one of the pieces in the New York Times story was that a one-shot reimbursement actually isn't enough. This is not a one-shot conversation. It's a conversation, then a contemplation, then more conversation. Do you not agree with that?
I do, and you have to return to it, but the initial discussion is probably the hardest. Once you've broach the dam, you can get there. And it is important to come back. Let me tell you some of the more interesting and somewhat amusing situations I've encountered. So people designate a decision maker. They say, oh, Marjorie, she knows Jim's wishes better than anyone. And then it turns out that Marjorie is mad at Jim because they had a fight and he never bothered to change her as the decision maker. So you want to update these things, particularly if you get, shall we say, divorced. I've had people turn around and say, they didn't tell me that they wanted me to make that decision if they couldn't about end-of-life care things. I'm not doing that. It might be useful to tell the person that you designate as your decision maker that you'd like them to do it and get them to agree. And in general, I think it's important to understand you fill one of these things out, say, in Massachusetts, but you winter in Arizona. Well, they may have slightly different laws there, so you may need two of these. So there are lots of reasons to have the discussion, to fill in your advance directive, to pick someone as your decision maker. But, you know, things change over time. People do travel and move around. So you have to update documents, and you may need to update, if you will, the discussion.
So what you're saying is Sarah Palin was right. This is a bad idea, right, Art? Okay, fine.
Yeah, well, did you want to call them death panels? I'd rather call it a conversation about death. I'm on board that. It's part of life. We ought to do it.
You know, Art Kaplan, I wonder why this is happening now. We've been hearing these horrific tales, and I'm sure you've got a million of them in your fingertips about siblings disagreeing in the hospital about what to do with mom and dad and the whole nine yards, divorced couples, et cetera. Why is this discussion happening now?
Costs continue to go up in healthcare, so that continues to trigger attention to what do people want. I think an aging population also is contributing here. The boomers are getting older. Right. They look out at all that technology and they start to say, I don't know. I'm not sure I'd like to be stuck on those machines. You know, one thing I noticed just recently, Joan Rivers, who had that terrible incident and wound up on life support at Mount Sinai Hospital here in New York, her children said they know what she wants. So one of the useful things to come out of that terrible event is that they did have the conversation. Maybe others can be inspired by that.
Art, I'm sorry, Marjorie.
We can move on.
Art, you don't know me well enough to know that Marjorie is convinced that I border on hypochondria, that I do.
Yes, I do.
Oh, you do? Okay. She thinks I should have doctors on retainer. I'm going to be elected to the MRI Hall of Fame any day here. I read about this thing that you are experiencing in New York City that's on its way potentially to Boston, what they're calling Uber for Doctors, this pager, this app that allows you to schedule house calls on demand, might expand into the Boston area. Tell us how it works and tell us what you think of it.
Well, first of all, I think it already exists in the Boston area. It's called traffic. Don't you have, like, doctors driving up and down the street constantly? I don't want to say they're ambulance chasers, but I think last time I was there, it seemed to me every other car was a doctor and nurse going somewhere. But that's just me. Anyway, I think it's not a bad idea to be able to get a house call. I think that's great. I think it's a tradition that many people miss. They're more comfortable having the doctor come to them than fearing to go into the hospital. So I don't have any big problem with it. Could it be overused? Yeah, but people like you, Jim, you're going to show up at the ER or the doctor's office. It's the fact that they're going to come to you isn't going to make you any less nutty.
I assume they talk about the flat rate of $199 on weekdays, $299 for evenings, weekends. That's not an insurance reimbursable thing, or is it?
And Let me pause here while the insurance company people laugh.
Okay, fine.
They're done now.
So, okay, so it's not. So what happens, according to this piece we read, it's called Pager, by the way. You enter your symptoms onto this app. Then a list of available doctors pops up. Once a doctor's selected, he or she calls you, makes an assessment about whether or not you need emergency care, et cetera. Then within 2 hours, they show up at your house. Is that actually happening in New York City?
They follow the Chinese food gang.
This is horrible.
But you know where I mean, even though that's a lot of money, $199 and $299 for eatings, I could see this, particularly with families with young kids, because you know how it is on the weekend. If one of your kids gets an ear infection or one of your kids you think might have a strep throat and it's a Saturday, most of the time your choice is wait until Monday, which you can't really do with the poor kid in pain, or go to the emergency room. And how long do you sit? I've sat for 4 hours, 5 hours in Children's Hospital emergency room. You can be there all night long. I mean, even with one of my kids with appendicitis, we were there for hours. So
you know what it means. It means only poor people are going to be in emergency rooms because they can't afford the $299,
well,
right?
It does mean that. But I suppose if you had your MasterCard at the ready, you might be, even if you're like, not rolling in dough, the trade-off between $199 on the MasterCard and sitting for 5 hours with a sick kid in the hospital, you'd do this in a second.
And one of the unfortunate facts about health reform is I think people hope that a lot of poorer people who show up for routine things would get out of the emergency room, but we haven't seen that happen as much. And it's got nothing to do with the doctor coming to you or vice versa. Habits are hard to change.
Right.
So the emergency room is still pretty full because that's where people are used to going. That's what they know. I'm not sure they know, what else to do or where else to go. But in general, bringing a doctor to you, I think it's a good idea. I have no issue at all with the house call coming back, and I think the worried well, like Jim, are better to spend this money there than on dying casinos in Atlantic City or something. You know,
that's a great line. The worried well, but just stay on this for a second. The thing I was just discussing with Marjorie. I mean, there are many parts of healthcare that have become two tiered. One for the wealthy. One for not wealthy. I mean, what are they called? Boutique practices?
Yep.
Where you
concierge
practices. I'm sorry. There's a very famous one here in Boston. I'm sure there are a number of them that have been written about. This does help create even a greater divide, though, does it not? Those who can afford special treatment and those who can't. Those who can afford first-class seats on an airline,
already,
those who can't.
It's already there.
But doesn't
you
it
have
exacerbate
a higher-end
it?
Healthcare plan or you don't.
So is that a concern, or is it maybe okay to get wealthy people out of emergency rooms so that there's more staff to handle more people who can't do this pager thing?
Well, the problem with boutique sort of high-end pay-an-extra-fee medicine, concierge medicine, is that when a doctor does that and goes into that kind of a practice, they promise to see the patient quickly and spend a lot of time with them and send each other emails and become your friend. And that's great, except it takes a lot of time. And so they see relatively fewer patients. They make up the difference by charging more to the richer people come to them. So there's actually less care overall available because people pull out of the system and wind up just taking care of a few very rich patients. So that's what my problem is. It has an equity, not just that rich people can buy better care, but as soon as doctors start, if you will, narrowing who their practice is aimed at, there's fewer of them to care for everybody else.
We're talking with our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. One more question about this from me, Art. You know, it is possible if you're pulling in $199 for weekday visits and $299 for evening and weekends, this could be an opportunity for those, up to their eye teeth in student debt, medical school debt, young doctors to get out there and make some money on the side, pay off their loans.
Mm-hmm. That's what we call moonlighting. To some extent, they're not supposed to do it, depending on whether they're a resident and so forth, because you're only supposed to work so many hours. You're reminding me, Margie, one of the things that'll be interesting to watch is both who the doctors are that do this and whether they're kind of overdoing their fixed limits on hours. Remember, we put in time limits, weekly hours and so forth, that people could work to try and reduce errors so they wouldn't have sleepy people taking care of you. But this is an area where they could kind of do it on the side, and it'll be interesting to see whether it's possible to police that at all.
Well, if they police it and there aren't enough doctors, the Uber drivers can give medical care. Why not? It's like a twofer.
You know, if they ride around with the doctors long enough and they have enough conversation, maybe.
Art Kaplan from NYU's Langone Medical Center, a medical ethicist. Brains zapping. Marjorie and I were reading about this morning, where these magnetic currents are directed, shot, I guess, at subjects' heads. And the initial research suggests that it will stimulate and improve the memory function. While they're talking about the difference being slight enough that the primary value is for people who have, you know, damaged memory because of trauma or Alzheimer's, that sort of thing. Is there potential in something that almost seems like magic to me as an outsider to deal with normal people just aging and memory issues, or no?
Oh, 100%. You know,
really?
I can hear the sound of entrepreneurs at a board meeting saying, hey, why don't we set up a clinic and aim it at, you know, normal folks, but say, hey, can't remember the keys, where you put them? How about getting your brain a little bit shocked for a fee here? This will jazz you up. You need an edge at work, trying to get into a fancy graduate school, want to beat out, there's a potential for abuse here too. And let me call it abuse, because the fact that this research has appeared, you want it confirmed many, many times. You want to know if it does anything either medium or long term to the rest of your memory. I don't like people sort of jumping the gun and getting out there saying, I'm going to offer a service to make your memory a little better. Who doesn't want better memory? I think that's eminently marketable and predictably unethical. At this point.
Okay, so I was very excited about it this morning. Maybe I'm not so excited about it now, but let me ask you something.
Well, you can't remember.
That's right.
But I'm bummed.
Well, that is what I wonder. Why is it that as people age, their memory starts to go? Is it clogged arteries in their head or something? What's the reason?
All kinds of factors, different ones for different people. So some people are getting early stage Alzheimer's. They're getting chemical gunk buildup around their brain cells, and that impairs memory. For some people, it is circulatory. They start to lose circulation. Some people have little strokes, tiny mini strokes, they're called, and that cuts off parts of circulation of the brain. And then there's just plain aging. You know, aging in itself does wear out cells. They only have so many divisions in them, and that can cause different types of effects on the body, which can affect memory as well. So there are a lot of reasons why memory or cognitive function starts to decline a little bit in old age. And let me add, I know everybody out there is playing Sudoku and trying to keep active. There's not a ton of evidence that that really does much against those biological processes.
So all those brain training games and talk about entrepreneurs online, I mean, they're making lots of money, mm-hmm. people signing up to do these memory games and stuff. You're thinking maybe not.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's much evidence that they work. I don't think they hurt you in any way. And if you like the games, that's fine. Yeah. But I don't know that they're memory builders.
Hey, let's stay on this for a second, Art Kaplan, but at the same time, step back, because I think the issue I'm going to raise applies to lots of experimental research, drugs, magnetic currents, etc. If a person who suffers from some memory loss, for example, or something else, says, I am fully aware of the decision I'm about to make. I understand there are risks. I heard Art Kaplan. It's far from proven, but I am knowingly willing to assume those risks.
Mm-hmm.
Why shouldn't they be able to do whatever they want to do with their own body and mind?
Well, they probably will be able to. The question is whether the Federal Trade Commission is going to come after the seller and say, you're selling snake oil. You can't do what you're advertising, so stop saying you can. And the FDA could jump in. These are medical devices. You know, these aren't just a piece of paper with a crossword puzzle on it. So they have some regulatory authority there, too, and they could say, show us the tests that confirm that this is safe. Oh, you didn't do any of those yet, or you haven't followed out people for a year or 2 years to see if there's any changes. So the individual probably could. It's going to come more on the marketing side.
But one last question on this. Assuming, putting those things aside, and I know they're not minimal issues at all, they're significant ones. If they didn't apply in a situation, but you determined, I mean, the generic you, determined that there were some risks, but they were risks that were knowingly taken by something that's unproven experimental, do you have a problem with a patient saying, bring it on?
I don't, as long as they really understand what's going on. The problem is, psychologically, people want to believe that doing something is better than doing nothing. Yeah. And that turns out it's not always true. And then they don't listen to the downside. When you survey them after the fact and say, you know, this had a certain risk, did you hear it or pay attention to it? And they said, yeah, but I never assumed it was going to happen to me. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, as long as they really understand, comprehend, you quiz them, they answer questions, then I think, you know, you're your last arbiter on that sort of risk-benefit thing. It's similar to whether you want to bungee jump or ride horses or do other risky things.
All right, Catherine, what's really going on here is Mr. Worried Well over here couldn't find his car keys this morning, and now he's licking and he's a little zapping to get back in shape. Anyway, let's move on to this good news, I think, about the National Institutes of Health Clinical Center in Maryland. They're testing, going to be testing this fall a Ebola vaccine, and this is good news, is it not?
Very good news. The vaccine, like all vaccines, has to be tested to make sure it doesn't have side effects. And I know there are some people worried about vaccines out there, but these get tested on tens of thousands of people. These are large-scale tests, so you want to make sure they really don't have any side effects or any problems. And then you want to figure out, I'll tell you what the ethics issue is. Let's say the Ebola vaccine turns out to be, I don't know, 40% effective. That's pretty good. It's not bad. But it gives you a false sense of security that maybe you don't have to wear a mask or goggles or disinfect because you got the vaccine, which may not be true. There's a vaccine, Marjorie, that you know about, HPV vaccine.
Yes.
It's not 100%. So you still want to get your pap smears, and you still want to make sure that you know, you're alert to the idea that this doesn't give you 100% protection against cervical cancer. So the ethics question is, how good should it be before you make it available? In a plague, 40% may sound just fine. In ordinary times, it may sound ridiculously low, and you say, does somebody go back to the drawing board and come up with something that's more effective than 40% of the time?
Is it pretty obvious that the reason for the speed or urgency with which this is being tested is totally a function of what's happening in West Africa? I mean, that's pretty obvious, yes?
It is. And, you know, Jim, the problem with these rare diseases that affect poor people in poor lands is that there really is no market for making vaccines for them. So Ebola has broken out, I think, four times since 1976. It's actually rare, nasty, horrible disease, but it doesn't occur that much. It takes place in countries like Guinea and Sierra Leone and Liberia. They don't have any money to buy anything. So there's no real motivation for private industry to make the vaccine. The only reason we had a vaccine under development and we heard about those drugs that the two missionaries got and a few other people got, it's because of bioterror. Our government and the Canadian government had funded some of that in case somebody released Ebola here or we had to deploy troops someplace where it was. That's the sole reason anything exists.
Let me just say one last thing we mentioned last week, speaking of Ebola. If people have not seen the New York Times series piece on the nurses and the so-called burial boys, it's about as powerful and moving a story about the frontline people dealing with this in Africa. It is just, it is incredibly powerful. Art, thanks as always.
Hey, my pleasure.
Thank you very much for being here. Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Up next, another journalist has been murdered by ISIS. Last week, President Obama said they are still trying to figure out a strategy to deal with the Islamic militant group. But is there even such a thing as the right strategy? Homeland Security expert Juliet Kayyem joins us next for that conversation on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. As you know, Stephen Sotloff is the second American journalist who's been beheaded by ISIS. In a video released yesterday, Sotloff addresses the camera and describes himself as, quote, paying the price for Barack Obama's decision to strike ISIS in northern Iraq. So is there anything the U.S. could have done to prevent the murder of Sotloff? And what should the United States do now? Here with us in Studio 3 for her read on this is Homeland Security expert Juliet Kayyem. Juliet joins us every Wednesday for Open Mic. Hello there, Juliet.
Hi.
Hi, Juliet. Before we get to your answer about what we could do now, I just want to play you some sound, a timeline of the last couple of weeks. First, you're going to hear Stephen Sotloff's mother, Shirley, asking for the release of her son. Then you'll hear the executioner of Stephen Sotloff speaking to President Obama. Finally, you'll hear Obama speaking in Estonia about the execution.
As a mother, I ask your justice to be merciful and not punish my son for matters he has no control over. I ask you to use your authority to spare his life.
So just as your missiles continue to strike our people, our knife will continue to strike the necks of your people.
Like people around the world, Americans are repulsed by their barbarism. We will not be intimidated. Their horrific acts only unite us as a country and stiffen our resolve to take the fight against these terrorists.
So, Julia, as you know, Barack Obama was criticized roundly, even by Democrats, for saying he had, quote-unquote, no strategy about Syria. Now there's going to be even more pressure to strike ISIS. What are his options?
Well, his first option is to take a deep breath. The clause that he said, or the statement that he said about not having a strategy, was clearly a statement about no strategy for a military mission in Syria. As I've been saying the last couple weeks about ISIS, is us bombing in Syria is a game changer. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. President Assad views our presence and military presence in Syria as different, even though he may not have control of parts of his border. And so one is that it is true we don't have a strategy. We don't know what would happen if we started to bomb in Syria. But when I say take a deep breath is we can't let ISIS set our timetable for policy. And we know that there is another journalist in line. A British journalist is next. If you follow the videos, they end with the next victim at the very end. But that is ISIS's timeline. And however brutal and horrible this whole situation is, our hand cannot be forced to begin military strikes in Syria, because that's what ISIS wants us to do. If we have a distinct mission in Syria, if we have the tacit or explicit consent of President Assad and regional players, then it will happen.
You know, I'm trying to get some historical perspective on this. It seems to me that a lot of this pressure is coming from the media and the talking heads and the 24/7. You know, he's got to do something. This whole, right, get up there and show your tough stuff, United States of America. That's true to a large degree.
It is. And it's this weekend, I believe it was this weekend, Senator John McCain had a editorial in The New York Times sort of urging a policy without, let's just be clear here, no one has been specific about what the policy should be. They just say, we need to do something. And you could have literally taken out the words ISIS and put in Iraq and redated that editorial for 2003, and it was the same thing, that somehow showing force is the only way to confront a threat whose existence in the homeland and its threat against America is unknown and likely overstated.
But, it's not fair to tell you, either of you, that it's just the media. That op-ed.
Well, it's politicians, too.
Right,
just politicians are critical. On Meet the Press, Dianne Feinstein, who's not exactly – she's a big-time Democrat, not exactly a wild critic of the president, said she agreed with what John McCain and Lindsey Graham wrote in that op-ed. It was Lindsey Graham from South Carolina. And used the words saying that the president may be cautious, too cautious. So I think the criticism is broader than that. However, the one thing I don't get historically, getting back to Marjorie's question about history – the day after thousands of Americans were killed on 9/11, even people who were critics of George Bush were saying, that was yesterday. What are you doing today? It was 2 days ago. What are you doing now? It seems to me it's such a function of the unpopularity of Barack Obama that the media Democrats, and I think much of the American population is saying, the clock's ticking. Do something now, when they didn't do the same thing with George W.
Right. I think that may be true. But let's just be – the polling also shows that if President Obama were to come out and say, I'm going to start bombing in Syria without the support of President Assad or tacit or explicit support of President Assad, and we're going to begin military missions to disrupt ISIS, that would not be so popular either. And so and also, can I just be clear? The idea that the policy or whatever we're doing is failing needs to be put in context. These military strikes, these airstrikes are actually working. Assad has said that they are working. They are disrupting ISIS. It doesn't mean it's perfect. We are in there with a coalition of probably the unwilling, as we're seeing across the region, bombing areas of Iraq. And who knows what's going on in Syria? One has to believe there's a lot of intelligence and other covert operations going on. So the idea that nothing's going on is just not true. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. We've got a bunch of civil wars going on in the region. Every country you look to, whether we've intervened like in Iraq or Libya, or we haven't intervened like in Syria, seems to be in the midst of ethnic war. We cannot let ISIS set our timetable for a smart policy. And the smart policy may be continuing to bomb in Iraq and seeing, you know, what the region and what our allies in the region would be willing to do.
Well, there's a quote from this guy, Daniel Benjamin. Was formerly with the State Department. Now he's at Dartmouth College this morning in the Globe, saying the pressure to do something is often the enemy of good policy.
Yes.
There'll be a clamor for the president to take military action, which may not be effective if he conducts airstrikes and doesn't get the desired effect. There'll be pressure for more airstrikes and then to put boots on the ground.
Right. That's exactly right. I know Dan from the administration. He was the counterterrorism ambassador for the State Department. And he knows what I know, which is that if you're sitting there making policy, it has to be based on what are the outcomes. And after Iraq, I just think that's a good lesson. I mean, that should be the way policy is worked out. Even with this horror of ISIS's sort of 2 weeks, we're going to execute a Western journalist.
See, that's why I think this conversation so far is somewhat not real, is as long as ISIS, who, and they are public relations geniuses.
Yes.
As long as they keep sending videos with Western journalists having their heads cut off, the reality is the pressure is – I mean,
Wait a minute. Public relations geniuses, I think a lot of people are absolutely disgusted and horrified.
Do you think if Marjorie, do you think if there was no video of a Foley or a Sotloff that there'd be this clamor? We've seen these. Well, a lot of us haven't, as we said, the Brian McGrory. We haven't watched the actual thing. But I'm telling you, if either of you think, and I'm not supporting this, I'm just stating what I see as the reality, that the president is going to be able to wisely, to use your word, I think, Juliet, sort of stand back from this if we continue to get a video every couple of weeks, I think the pressure is going to be absolutely out of control. Why are you shaking your head?
Because I think that's what you want the president to have the wisdom to say, I'm not, especially in a second term, I'm not going to succumb to all
this. No, I'm not disagreeing
clamor.
With your analysis, but it's a dispassionate analysis.
Re-elections and campaigns.
He's the first one. He's not running for re-election.
Okay, then
you think that if we continue to get a video every couple of weeks, like the one we got yesterday and the one we got a couple of weeks ago of James Foley, that the president can continue to say, I'm considering my options, I'll get back to you?
I hope he can, if it's not wise.
That's
not
my question.
Right. You're the expert. I'll let you answer that.
I think
that.
He's going to have to. I mean, I think we have I hate to say this. We may become immune to these videos if there are enough of them. And then we put ISIS – and then we own the timeline. And the timeline – let's just be clear. We are bombing in Iraq. We have 350 new troops going to Iraq. We clearly have covert operations in Syria because we've now heard of two attempts to release these journalists, one by the United States and one by Britain. The details are unclear in both instances, as they should be. And so that is just going to have to be the way it is. If we respond with bombing a nation that because of these videos – What's the game plan?
I'm not, do any of us think
that the videos will stop? I mean, if we actually start doing more, does John McCain actually think, okay, well, now ISIS is going to, you know, be nice? Of course not.
I think it's too rushed. Can we stay with a touch on one thing you just mentioned a minute ago? One thing that's getting totally lost is what you mentioned, because the anniversary of 9/11 is just days away. Yet another 300, what are they called euphemistically? Military advisors,
350.
Does that not suggest to you that in a year or 2 years, we're going to look back, we're going to see a timeline in the Boston Globe or the New York Times, 250 advisors on such and such a date, up to 800 right. on September? I mean, the potential for involvement again is immense.
Continues. It sounds like Vietnam. I mean, it sounds
exactly.
like the quiet American.
JFK.
And the quiet American. And then you know, what was he? He was a military advisor.
Yeah. We're talking with Juliet Kayyem, a national security, homeland security expert. Now, here's an email from Art. And I think Art is expressing what lots of people think. He says, what ISIS wants is all of us dead. Us bombing them or not doesn't really matter. We have one option to destroy them wherever they are. The longer we wait, the more powerful they become, the harder it will be. Once the beheading videos have the Colorado Mountains in the background instead of the desert, it will be too late. But that's where we'll be with 10 years, unless in 10 years if we don't get serious about this now. I think he's wrong, but maybe I'm crazy.
Well, let's just deconstruct the email. So first of all, everyone is taking this seriously. There's just disagreements on policy.
Right.
And the disagreements on policy are not at all clear to me, because if you actually pierce what John McCain is saying or what Dianne Feinstein is saying, it's really not that different. Maybe they just want a more forceful voice. And also, it is clear ISIS would love to rule the world. And what people need to understand is there's a difference between desire and capacity. Us bombing them in Iraq, trying to disrupt them through intelligence efforts, through getting the region engaged, which they clearly are in disrupting them, stopping the arms flow, stopping the money flow, is so that we don't have to address the question of whether they are a threat in the homeland. But let's not in the same way we don't want to underestimate the threat and the disruption they have to the region, let's not overestimate the threat that they might have to us in the homeland.
David Cameron, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, seems to think there's a pretty serious threat in the homeland there.
I mean, it's apples and oranges. Look, I mean, first of all, he has a couple hundred of missing Brits who are clearly fighting with ISIS.
He thinks it's 500.
Yeah, he thinks it's 500. And then if you add the other European countries, it's going to be over 1,000. They all have shared visa capability. They have shared, you know, the EU allows a free flow of people and goods and commerce. So he has a very, very different threat. It is, I will say, it's apples and oranges to say because he did it, we have to do it. And what he did was important, and in the same way, you know, sort of saying that this is a real threat, but essentially, in its nitty-gritty details, is he just wants the capacity to stop various people from going back and forth to Britain.
Can we change gears about to another subject about which?
Oh, just one last thing. Just about when you said the threat is very different between Great Britain and us. We have some, I think we discovered a few minutes ago before the show, 100 people from Minnesota or something that's supposedly out there. So fighting, missing and possibly fighting with these people. So 100 is not 1,000 or even 500, but that's still a significant number of people.
Right. And also, I mean, and we monitor them. We probably know who they are. We're checking passports. They're on no flight list. But in terms of the capability of people moving around the European continent from Syria, Libya, and those other countries, that's the fear that the prime minister is facing, and one that brought him to sort of demand these new changes.
Okay.
If I sound too calm, it's not that I am. This is a horrible, horrible threat. But the important thing is we need to not react, because we have reacted before in this country and started wars and invaded countries of which we had not thought through the consequences.
Well, speaking of react and potentially—
Actually, we're living those consequences.
We have repeatedly done it, by the way. Right.
Let's talk about overreaction potentially for a second. You have some connection, not to the bad side of this. We all were worked into a fevered pitch, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, over what was happening at the VA. When we heard these stories of former military people dying because they were in line waiting forever, for example, in Phoenix. Well, here's a line from the Washington Post fact-checking operation, their Pinocchio force or whatever they call it down there. Just because someone is on a waiting list when they died does not mean they died because they were on a waiting list. And they essentially debunk a huge percentage of the reporting that everybody has bought into, that these people died explicitly because they had to wait too long. What are the facts here?
I think, I mean, the Washington Post story is incredible because, I mean, this ultimately, the horror of what was happening at the VA led to Shinseki's, the former secretary's, resignation. What we know is that it is clear that the VA has a backlog. It is trying to update its computers. I have long believed, I've worked with the military all of my career, that the entire Veterans Administration system needs to be changed. It was built for conscription. It was built for world wars. It was built for men at a time when the men all joined the Army and they were going to live for 40 or 50 more years and they were going to have essentially single payer. And it hasn't worked. And the reason why it hasn't worked is because with the end of conscription, the isolation of our veterans, it's about, you know, less than 1% serve, less than 1% of the American population serves. Their medical needs are so different. I mean, we're dealing with PTSD and we're dealing with depression and high suicide rates. And we have this VA system that's very centralized and is not conducive to the intimacy that our veterans, who are quite young now, are going to face. What's interesting, if you look at the numbers of veterans, in our head we think, oh, there's going to be so many veterans because of these wars. Actually, because of the natural deaths of our World War II and Korean and Vietnam veterans, our veteran population is decreasing substantially over the course of the next 20 or 30 years. It is a perfect time, given the problems with computers and single payer within the veterans system, and because of the nature of the harms that or the medical needs of our veterans now, it is time that we revamped the administration, the sort of ministering of care for our veterans. Make it closer to home. Make it more intimate. Make it online.
Let me focus just for one more second. I don't know anybody who believes that there doesn't need to be major revamping of how this healthcare system for veterans works. But the issue is, the reason we were worked into a frenzy was not because there were waiting lines that shouldn't exist, even though they shouldn't exist, but because people were dying because of them. One of the things Marjorie and I discussed this morning, if the Washington Post was able to ferret out what it believes to be the facts, that the deaths are grossly overstated, why didn't the administration or the Veterans Administration, instead of taking Shinseki out, instead of admitting guilt, which they essentially did, if they weren't guilty as charged, why didn't they say it?
I agree. I was shocked at the story. I bought into the hype too. I mean, I read these stories and literally I thought people were in waiting rooms.
Yes.
And
exactly.
Dying. I mean, the way that they were written and they didn't push back. And it may have been because those stories were just reflective of a revamping of the Veterans Administration that was happening too slowly. The computers, they had so many problems with getting everything online. And it's time to rethink the entire system for our veterans, just given that we don't have conscription anymore.
But you think it's likely to happen?
I hope so. I mean, you're going to get push from a lot of these veterans who are very politically savvy, as we've seen, who are endorsing candidates and getting out there. They're not necessarily Democrat or Republican. And you're also going to see it actually from a lot of the governors who are facing populations that are very, very different, veterans populations that are making demands of both state resources and federal resources. So that is that will be good.
So what's the argument against it, though? What's the argument for against changing it?
I mean, it works for large populations.
Okay.
But those populations are passing away.
But one of the other arguments is now allowing them, as at least an interim measure, to go to private doctors if there's a long waiting list is expensive. And so even though everybody in Congress says they love the veterans, are they willing to pay the price to serve the veterans adequately? You know, before you go, this is I don't even know how we do this segue. Marjorie and I were talking about you this morning. And Marjorie, what did you say was one of the memorable quotes from Juliette Kayyem when she was first in the studio when she was running for governor? Could you repeat that?
I asked her why she was running for governor, and she said to me, because I hate my children.
That was on the air, but that was on the air.
Yeah. But
I love them.
But
I
you have a school story involving your children. So please tell us.
I guess I should do a shout shout out to, I know we all love summer and I know we all love the beach days, but I probably reflect millions of parents out there who yesterday morning came home or got, you know, a coffee and the house was empty at 8:20 in the morning.
Yes.
And I just thought, like, you know, I had said, you know, it is 5 o'clock somewhere. You know, it is, summer is always 1 week too long in my house. I'm like, get these kids out of here. No, they're back in school and it is exciting. I mean, we had a great summer of vacation and travel. My kids are actually happy because their other mother, as we like to say in my house, I am married, but my kids have two mothers. She's known as Airport Mom. She doesn't come back out till Thanksgiving, which is our next flight. Airport Mom is horrible, and she's me. There's something about airport. You know, I'm normally very laid back in California.
Oh, yeah.
And like, well, no, I mean, I have this, you know, sort of California sentiment. I'm not overbearing with my kids. I'm probably too lax with them, in fact. But Airport Mom, boy, she's wicked. Something about airports, and I know it's true, there's airport dads, you're like cruel to the
stressful
kids. I know. And like, you know, they have to obey you, and you take, you know, delays in airlines because of weather as personal slights. And, you know, the whole thing is just horrible. And so my kids call me Airport Mom. She sort of emerges coming out of the tunnel as we see the signs for Logan.
Uh-huh.
And they all stand back. They just say, just let her be.
You know, since you quoted Julia Kayyem, what's fair, what's good for the goose, as they say, I'm going to quote you from years ago.
Okay.
Oh.
Marjorie comes into the studio one day in September, and she utters one of the most famous lines in American history: "Free at last, free at last! Thank God Almighty, free at last!" Now, what were you speaking about, Marjorie?
Well, it was the same thing when my kids went back to school.
She was guilt-ridden. We should be clear.
Yeah, you know that they're leaving the house, and you know you don't. There's not enough. They're in school. There's not in school enough. Let's put it this way: they should be in school.
I agree.
48 weeks of the year.
Last week, you had a conversation about whether kids should sleep in, like they're not getting enough sleep, and I am like, no freaking way. I want them out of the house at 6:30. Get my run in.
Yeah.
I was like, for working parents, you know, you just, it is, summer is always a week too long. But I agree with you. Marjorie, it is 5 o'clock somewhere.
That's
if you
right.
need some help,
that's
I'm
right.
here for
that's
you.
Right. Well, better they call you Airport Mom than Too Many Cocktails Mom or something like that. Julia Kayyem, always great to talk
Thanks.
To you. I hope you have a very, enjoy your peaceful mornings this week. Relish
oh, thank
them.
Thank you. Thank
okay.
you. See you next
Good to
week.
See you,
thank you very much for being here. Up next, we are going to continue our series of interviews with the gubernatorial candidates prior to this Tuesday's primary. We're going to be joined in Studio 3 by State Treasurer Steve Grossman. Stay tuned for that.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3, bearing gifts, I should say. We'll tell you that in a minute. For his final interview as a gubernatorial primary candidate is...
At 92, I can't do much to help my son run for governor, except make this ad. He should smile more, but he's the best Democrat in the race. I should know. I vote that way since FDR.
And that, of course, is State Treasurer Steve Grossman. Steve, it's good to see you.
We're just kind of breaking up here in the studio because Juliet sends me a tweet about an hour ago and says, I know you're on right after me. What's your favorite flavor of ice cream? So I said, well, what's yours? She says, mint chip. So I went over to J.P. Licks, got her a nice container of homemade mint chip, and I can't come empty-handed. So I gave Marjorie first choice. She picked the cookie dough. Jim got chocolate chip. I probably should have given you first choice because I'm on with you tomorrow night.
You are.
On this final debate of the campaign.
Yes. I would have if I were you.
With the cable, 6 to 7. But
you can bring some tomorrow night.
Yeah, maybe I'll
I don't want to overdo it here.
Yeah.
What's your ice cream? What's your ice cream thing through the years? What's that deal with you?
No, there's no deal. I mean, when my father and I, when I was living at home every night at 11 o'clock, I'd go down for the 11 o'clock news. My father would put together bowls of chocolate chip and mocha almond from Brigham's. He'd get me one. I'd sit there with him, and we just got into
it.
I love ice cream. We did 71 homemade ice cream shops when I ran for state treasurer all over the state. Have you ever seen anybody with a bowl of ice cream in front of them that didn't have a smile on their face?
That's a very good point. Do you want a little advice from me?
Yeah.
If this governor thing doesn't work out, you can do one of those trucks that goes through the neighborhoods with that little song.
There you go.
Steve, good to see you.
Before we get into some serious policy things, by the way, thank you very much for the chocolate chip cookie dough. I appreciate it. The ad with your mother is just incredible. She's 92 years old, going strong. We should all hope to do as well as she does at 92 years old. But she says that you don't smile enough, you don't call her enough. Okay, now what's the deal there? Can that really be true?
Well, it's probably I don't smile enough. Other people have said that as well. You know, you get serious, you're into issues and policy, and you're seriously laying it all out. But you got to be warm, and people, you know, there's an old adage in politics. First, they get to know you, and they decide whether they like you.
Yeah.
Then they decide whether to vote for you or not. And smiling is part of a warm relationship with people. I've learned a little bit more about sort of building those relationships over the years. But my mother calls it the way she sees it.
Uh-huh.
She went back to her 25th reunion at Smith College in 1968, 46 years ago. She met a young lady. She came home. She says, "Do I have the girl for you?" I said, "Mom, I'm not going to do this. Please." She said, "Look, she's beautiful. She's brilliant. She's much too good for you. Call her anyhow." So she stood over me until I called Barbara Wallace, now Barbara Wallace Grossman. That was 46 years ago. My mother is a rock star.
What a great story. Okay, so let's get down to some serious business. Are we ready?
I thought we were. My relationship with Barbara is the most serious thing out there.
Okay. Well, we do have to move on to a little bit of policy thing.
All right.
You and Martha Coakley are in a three-way race with, of course, Dr. Mm-hmm. Berwick for the Democratic nomination. You have said that Martha Coakley, the Attorney General, has not been bold enough in some of her proposals. What are you talking about?
I think if you're running for governor, you need to lay out a comprehensive vision for what you are going to do and how you're going to deal with the most intractable, biggest challenges we face. And, you know, Martha, all too often, when she's asked a tough question, she says, "Well, I'm open to it. I'm open to that. I'm open to that." You know, I think you've got to be decisive. Voters may say, "I don't like that position. I don't agree with that position." But I think being decisive and taking a stand is important.
Where she said that? Is there some? Give me a couple of examples.
On the issue of driver's licenses for all immigrants.
Uh-huh.
I think all immigrants should have driver's licenses. I think it's a public safety issue. Why would we want anybody driving around on the streets of Massachusetts, on the roads, without driver's ed, driver's test, a driver's license, and insurance? To me, it's just common sense. She's open to it. Take a stand. She's open to the idea that, hey, if we vote to repeal the casino legislation on the 4th of November, which is the right of the people of Massachusetts, Supreme Judicial Court said we have that right, she says, "Well, I'm open to considering maybe we should have a casino in Springfield." You know, because that's the Charlie Baker position. Charlie says, "Well, even if it's overturned," he said, "I would be willing to file legislation." Charlie Baker's wrong. Martha Coakley's wrong. Democracy matters. If the will of the people is that we don't have casinos, then we shouldn't have casinos. And I would oppose that. I wouldn't file legislation, and I would veto such legislation. So you can't be open. Ed Koch once said, let me just quote
former
Ed Koch.
Mayor of New York City.
Yeah, it's a great line. Ed Koch once said, if you agree with me on 8 out of 12 issues, vote for me. If you agree with me on 12 out of 12 issues, you should see a psychiatrist.
But Steve, on this issue of her saying, "I want to think about this, I have an open mind," let me talk about something that you were involved in. Martha Coakley negotiated a deal with Partners, and largest the physicians network hospital, et cetera, in Massachusetts. Your original response to her deal was it was a common sense solution. You've done a 180. You now think it was a bad deal. If you had embraced the Martha Coakley approach and basically said, "I'm open, I want to think about it, I'm open to embracing this," wouldn't you have been better off than essentially jumping the gun, which is what you want her to do before she's made her mind up? Isn't that a fair criticism of you?
Well, people could say that. But let me tell you what really happened. Back in May, a few details of the agreement that she had with Partners Healthcare came out. And the Health Policy Commission, led by Stuart Altman, I mean, they are the most authoritative group in the state, they said, this might be a common sense idea. I take my guidance from the Health Policy Commission. They are smart, savvy, and they know what they're doing. But when the full deal came out, and all of a sudden, Health Policy Commission sees that it's going to raise rates by $15 to $23 million, tens of millions of dollars on the backs of families, small businesses. Stuart Altman of the Health Policy Commission said, absolutely not. This is going to blow the cap. This is going to cause rates to go up. Even her own representative on the Health Policy Commission said, this is a money grab. At that point, once the deal was absolutely laid out in all the details, and the Health Policy Commission says, I'm sorry, this doesn't wash, I was forced to say, I can't support this. So I do take my guidance from people who are smarter than I am. I'm not a healthcare expert. I'm not a doctor. But I do know brain power when I see one. And if the HPC, the Health Policy Commission, says this is a bad deal, I have to agree with that. I think she's wrong on this one.
You know, Treasurer Grossman, a couple things about casinos. The more we have talked about casinos, the more terrible predictions I hear about casinos closing down here, going bankrupt there. They're not bringing the money they thought they were going to bring in. So why are you still in favor of casinos as a jobs creation program? I mean, I'm thinking of them as pretty horrible these days.
Look, there's going to be a big debate between now and November 4th on this issue, and the people of the state are going to vote. And what I've said all along, when I supported this, Governor Patrick said he supported it. He supported it because it would, according to the Mass Taxpayers Foundation, they did a pretty authoritative study of this issue. They said it'll create 15,000 jobs, half in the construction sector. Unemployment is still running 30-40% in some construction trades, not in Boston, not in Cambridge, but certainly in Springfield, in the South Coast, in some of the parts of the state that are really still hard hit, unemployment rates of 10+%. I've looked into the eyes of sheet metal workers and carpenters, and they haven't worked in 3 winters. They're on food stamps. They've lost their homes. Jobs are important, and the service sector jobs are $45,000 and up. Good health benefits, good pension benefits, mostly union jobs. So I say 15,000 jobs. I also say that if Massachusetts people are spending roughly $850 million in Connecticut and Rhode Island, and 25% of that would be returned to the taxpayers of Massachusetts, that's more than $200 million of revenue. I say that if $300 million of revenue can result, and if that would fully fund universal pre-K education for every one of the 25,000 3- and 4-year-olds in the state, then I'm going to support it. But if the people of Massachusetts vote to overturn it, and here's I agree with Don Berwick on this one, how are we going to say democracy doesn't matter and we're simply going to thumb our noses at democracy and the will of the people and say, no, we're going to still support a bill that would create a casino in Springfield anyhow? I wouldn't support it. I couldn't. Martha Coakley and I are 180 degrees opposite on this issue.
But if the people of Springfield do want it, and they've indicated they do want it, and unemployment is Springfield has a real serious problem with unemployment, why not let Springfield be the exception to the rule? They do want it. Because that's democracy at work.
Because I think the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts basically said the people of Massachusetts as a body have the right to make this call. If they make this call and say we want it, then we'll have casinos. If they say no, thumbs down, this is not what we want, then we'll have to come back and create jobs some other way. This is not the only way to create jobs in Massachusetts, but it is something that the people of Massachusetts have a right to decide. And I don't think anybody, even a governor, has the right to say, I'm sorry, democracy doesn't matter. We fought for this for hundreds of years. We should allow democracy to work and work effectively.
But Steve, let's stay on, Steve Grossman, stay on casinos just for a second. I'm going to use the example of the Health Policy Commission that you just used as to why your position evolved, let's say, on the partners deal that Martha Coakley negotiated. Since you said, and you, the governor, and you said we support this thing, experts have spoken. Experts in the customers. They're not going in Atlantic City. As you know, 4 of the 12 casinos are going to be closed by the end of the year, including Trump's. Revenues, gambling revenues, customers, again, are down in Connecticut. So if there are a new set of facts, as you say, on the partners deal, there are a new set of facts since you originally endorsed this casino legislation, which suggests that Shelley Adelson, that Republican contributor from Dorchester, the owner of the Sands, is right, that this is too much for Massachusetts right now when the business of casinos on the East Coast is on the decline, not on the upswing.
Well, the gambling legislation, the bill to expand casino gambling, gave the Gambling Commission, the Gaming Commission, the right to establish up to 3 casinos.
Correct.
As well as 1 slot parlor.
Mm-hmm.
They've awarded the slot parlor license. It's being built as we speak. They awarded a casino in Springfield. They will decide sometime fairly soon whether to do a casino and where to do the casino in Boston. The southeastern Massachusetts one is mired in a lot of issues, and that may take a lot longer.
Should they hold, by the way, just, I'm sorry to interrupt you, should they hold on the eastern Mass decision like Marty Walsh wanted them to do, or should they move ahead as they voted unanimously that they're going to do? Meaning, Walsh's position is, until the ballot question is decided, don't award the eastern Mass casino.
If they had asked my opinion, I would have said, wait until after the people decide on the 4th of November and then award it. Mm-hmm. But that's not what they decided. They said they're going to award. It's not going to matter in any case because nobody's putting any money down. The Springfield people are not going to pay their $85 million. It's sort of now been put on hold until such time as the people decide. But again, we still spend over $800 million in Connecticut and Twin Rivers in Rhode Island. And that's $200 million of revenue that Massachusetts people spend. So I say, let's bring that money back to Massachusetts and use it for local aid, for firefighters, for teachers, for freezing fees and tuitions for our college students, for whatever purpose that money was intended.
Oh, we're talking to Steve Grossman. He is the treasurer of the Commonwealth, running in the Democratic primary for governor next Tuesday.
Steve,
by the way, the ice cream is fabulous. Thank you.
Is it
took
good?
A bite while Margaret was speaking.
I'm not going to take a bite until
really
the break
good.
Because it's against the rules, Jim.
It's really good.
Eat on the air. You're not supposed to do that, Commissioner. Treasurer Grossman. I want to ask you about something that you might do were you to become the governor. Mm-hmm. You know, after the terrible shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, unarmed black teenager killed by a white police officer, there's been an examination. The Globe just did a story about diversity in the police departments around Massachusetts, and they're not nearly as bad as Ferguson, which is almost all white police department. But they're not great either. And local officials who talked to the Globe about this said that they have really been trying for years to diversify police departments. Boston is one of the only ones that it all gets close to representing the number of minority and blacks in the city and the number on the police department. They blame failed recruitment efforts and obstructive state civil service rules that govern the hiring of new police officers. If you were to become the governor, how would you address this issue of lack of diversity in police forces here?
I would do it much in the same way that I addressed the issue when I became state treasurer. I mean, I stood up in front of the people of Massachusetts in January of 2011 and said two things. First, we're going to hire the best people for every job, which is what people expect, good people being hired to do the work of the people. Second, I said hiring will reflect the diversity of the society in which we live. I threw the book away, hired a new HR director, now deputy treasurer, Jesse St. Cyr. I said, Jesse, revolutionize our hiring practices. She changed the whole way we do business. Instead of just going and posting it online, she reached out to the Black Ministerial Alliance, the Organization of Latino Accountants, Black Lawyers Organization. She reached out to diverse people all over the state. What was the result? 35% of the people we've hired at Treasury in the last 3.5 years have been from diverse backgrounds. Martha Coakley's record over 8 years is about 15%. If you fundamentally change the way you do business and you're open and accessible and you invite people in to be part of the process and they really think the jobs are available to them, they don't think it's just a sham, they will apply. They will look for those jobs. And if you could get some help, you can diversify your organizations much more quickly than most people. I think when you don't diversify, it's a failure of leadership, not failure of some system out there. This is about leadership. This is about sending a clear message that diversity matters, that in a state that has more than 1 million people who weren't born in Massachusetts, a state that is getting more diverse all the time, diversity must be our strength, not a weakness. You don't have to choose between great people and diversity. That is not a choice. That is something that can coexist. It's done it. We've done it at Treasury. I have a track record on that. And when I'm governor and I oversee a state with 85,000 workers and a $36 billion budget, that's a chance to really affect in a serious way how we have done our business around diversity in the state for a long, long time.
That's the voice of Shirley Grossman's son, Steve Grossman. He's a treasurer. He is running for governor. On a related criminal justice thing, a high-profile Super PAC ad supporting you attacked Martha Coakley, and you've echoed some of the sentiments in it, for her not supporting Deval Patrick's limitation to being able to buy one weapon a month. Her explanation is she has other priorities. You don't really think that because of her position on this one issue that she doesn't care about gun control as much as you do, do you, Steve Grossman, honestly?
No, but I think good public policy is about taking clear and strong positions and driving that agenda forward. We know that limiting gun sales saves lives. We know that. That's a fact. You've had John Rosenthal in here, I'm sure, from Stop Handgun Violence.
Yeah.
He is one of the most brilliant leaders in the country on limiting gun sales and saving lives. I mean, I went over to Roxbury one night, and I looked into the eyes of women who had lost sons to gun violence, lost their children, buried their boys. And one of them said to me on the phone, she had lost a son, she said, "The only place I can go to escape is in the bathroom. I lock myself in the bathroom." And she said, "You're right. We should limit gun sales. We should not only limit gun sales," which they did in Virginia, by the way, when Doug Wilder was governor 19 years ago, and it reduced the incidence of guns used for violence. You and I debated this with Jim Wallace one night on
gun
your show.
Gun owners, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we debated this issue, and it's clear that what Doug Wilder did in Virginia had a dramatic impact on the presence of guns in gun-related crimes. It's not just about limiting gun sales. It's about smart gun technology. I mean, the attorney general says, "I don't have the power to do that." Scott Harshberger says, "No, you do. If you can regulate toy guns as attorney general, you darn well should be able to regulate real ones."
But that's another example. That's a big issue in the contest between Maura Healey and Warren Tolman. And by the way, Scott Harshberger supports Warren Tolman, who says he does have the power. Another example. Do you think Martha Coakley, if she thought she had the regulatory power, as Warren Tolman says she does, to immediately say smart gun technology, meaning fingerprint recognition, should be implemented? You think if she thought she had the power, she wouldn't do it?
Jim, it's a style of leadership. I've been an activist treasurer. When I came in here, when I was running for treasurer, I made some promises. Put checkbook online. Put every contract out to bid. Use the power of treasury to create jobs. No treasurer has ever used the power of the treasury to create jobs before. Nobody thought you had the power. What did I do? I took our money, brought it back from Europe, Australia, and Asia, put it in local banks. And the result is over 9,000 loans and $1.5 billion of small business lending. We're not responsible for all those loans, but we've been a catalyst. So if you're an activist treasurer, and you could do things. Imagine what I can do as an activist governor, taking strong, decisive positions. People may agree. People may disagree. I think they want somebody who knows what he's doing. The Boston Globe editorial that endorsed me on Sunday said something very interesting at the beginning. They said the next governor is going to make decisions that will affect the economic destiny of Massachusetts. And only one candidate has the skills, the background, the training, the ideas, the vision to make that happen. And that's me. And I was honored to have that endorsement, and I believe that's true. And we'll talk on the debate tonight and on your show tomorrow night about this issue. And I hope economic development and job creation is going to be a key ingredient, because the best social program we all know that's ever been created is a job.
Well, Steve Grossman, you just mentioned the Globe editorial. Mm-hmm. Congratulations for getting the endorsement of the Boston Globe. And I talk to people that have been Democratic activists for a long time. A lot of my family down in Fall River, actually, they absolutely adore you. They just think you're the greatest thing. And you have a massive amount of support from the grassroots Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
But you're still behind in Martha Coakley in the polls. I think the closest you've been is 12 points apart.
Mm-hmm.
The primary is Tuesday.
Right.
So what do you think is going to make the difference between now and then that could make you the Democratic nominee?
So here's what I believe. I believe that people are going to decide very late in this election. I think that people haven't been focusing a lot on it. They may not have seen the three candidates on the same stage. They'll have a chance to see that on channels 5 and 7 tonight at 7 o'clock, and then with Jim tomorrow night, 6 o'clock on NECN.
And simulcast on WGBH Radio tomorrow night,
Thank you. So they'll have a chance to sort of kick the tires and decide which one of these cars do I want to drive off the showroom floor, to use the metaphor. So I think people will decide late. I think when they look at me versus Martha Coakley versus Don Berwick, I think they're going to say, this guy who's been a proven jobs creator, he did it in his family business. He treated his workers with respect. He did it as state treasurer. He's got a plan. He's got a vision. And he knows what he's doing. And we trust him to make this happen for us and our families. My vision for this governorship in 4 years is really to create a gateway to the future for tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people who have been left out and left behind, people on waiting lists for English for second language, people who have not the workforce training, 1,000 jobs in Fall River that are ready to be filled. They don't have the training. They don't have the education. We've got work to do, and it's all around jobs, education, linking that all up. I can challenge the business community in ways that neither Martha or Don can, because I've been part of that business community. Business community's got to step up to the plate. If they want men and women and human capital, if they want young people to stay here long term, we've got to fix the housing problem, the transportation problem, create jobs, 5,000 summer paid internships. Those are the things that I have talked about in this campaign. It's been an exciting campaign. We've got 6 days left. I will continue to make the case. I believe this will be a barn burner coming right down to the close.
Okay, Steve Grossman, before you go, we need a promise from you.
Yes, ma'am.
Here it is.
More ice cream the next time I come?
Well, the ice cream is very good, and I'm going to stuff as much of it I can into my mouth between this break and the next one. If you become the next governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, we have had Deval Patrick in here with us once a month during the time he's been the governor. Promise us, if you win, you'll be with us once a month, too?
Not only will I promise to be in here once a month, but I will even promise on one of my first visits to bring my mother, Shirley Grossman, with me.
Boy, that
there
is
you go.
And by the way, if you can't come, Shirley can come.
I understand. I figure when people say to me, oh, my goodness, Barbara Grossman, your wife, she was so terrific. She went to Salem. She went to Peabody. You know something? The next time you need somebody to come, send Barbara. You stay home.
Steve, it's great to see you.
Thank
what
you,
is
Jim.
The Steve Grossman website, please?
SteveGrossman.com.
Thank you very
Twitter
much.
Twitter and Facebook, Steve Grossman, MA.
Oh, thank you very much for being here, and good luck with Jim Browdy and the debate, tonight on Channel 5 and Channel 7.
Enjoy the ice cream.
Thank you.
We will. Thank you. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Up next, we talked earlier in the day with Art Kaplan, a medical ethicist, about this new deal that allows you to page your doctor and have him show up right in your house within 2 hours. You into this? Even if it costs you $1.99 a pop and $2.99 a pop on weekends? We'll ask you that next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Earlier in the show, as Marjorie said, we spoke with medical ethicist Art Kaplan about a new app. It's called Pager. It schedules house calls on demand, and it's slated to come to Boston, possibly later this year. Here's how it works. You enter your symptoms, then a list of available doctors pops up. And once you've decided on a doctor, he or she will arrive within 2 hours. They call you first just to check out to make sure you don't need an emergency room. But again, within 2 hours, they will show up at your house. You get billed out of pocket, flat rate $199 for weekdays, $299 for evenings and weekends. So, is this a great way to bypass endless waits at the waiting room, the emergency room, particularly if you have kids? Or is this another way of increasing the wealth gap? The rich get one kind of care, while the poor can't afford it. Here's Art Kaplan earlier today. Here's his take on this.
Well, the problem with sort of high-end pay-an-extra-fee medicine is that when a doctor does that and goes into that kind of a practice, they promise to see the patient quickly and spend a lot of time with them and send each other emails and become your friend. And that's great, except it takes a lot of time. And so they see relatively fewer patients. They make up the difference by charging more to the richer people come to them. So there's actually less care overall available because people pull out of the system and wind up just taking care of a few very rich patients. So that's what my problem is. It has an equity, not just that rich people can buy better care, but as soon as doctors start, if you will, narrowing who their practice is aimed at, there's fewer of them to care for everybody else.
So we want to know where you are on this at 877-301-8970. Again, it could come to Boston in the very near future. 877-301-8970. Is the house call something you'd opt to do? Are the benefits of staying out of a doctor's office or the hospital, the emergency room, where there are lots of germs and you stand a higher risk of getting sick and you may have to wait forever, worth $200 or $300? And as Art told us, the insurance company will not be reimbursing you anytime soon. Or as Art suggested, is this another way that the rich can get top-notch medical care at the snap of their fingers at the expense of others? 877-301-8970. Can I answer both questions? Yes, I would do it. And two, it is absolutely and horribly unfair. The reality is, how many people can afford $300 on an evening or a weekend that you're not going to get reimbursed by your insurance company?
Well, desperate
That's a lot of money.
Call for desperate measures, Jimmy. You know
I understand,
saying?
But the reality is, it is a lot of money, and more often than not, people who have a ton of dough, middle class and up. Middle class and up, or at least upper middle class and up, are going to use this service, and the vast majority of people are not going to be able to afford it.
Did you say that the physician shows up with the medicine in the hand?
Is that what they do,
yes,
allegedly?
That's another great thing. You don't have to bother about going to Walgreens or CVS or worrying about your prescriptions or having to hobble down there in your compromised state. He shows up with the medicine within 2 hours. I think that the urge to do this when you're in extremis, particularly if it's kids and you have a lot of them, is real. I mean, think about the times when your kids were little, going out to the emergency room at 2 o'clock in the morning because the baby's got an earache, or you're going, or your kid's got a strep throat kind of thing, and the doctor's closed, and you have to sit there for hours.
I agree. It's very seductive.
Just to get a throat culture. You know what's disgraceful? Why don't these physicians have after hours? I mean, they do have physicians on call, but they're not going to come help you. They're not going to go into the office and help you. You can call them up, and then they tell you, well, I think
you have a
problem.
Well, you go to the outpatient clinic, but you have to wait, essentially. That's what they will refer you. They're not going to abandon you. If it's after hours, they'll say,
do you go to the outpatient clinic?
I've been there almost more than I've been at the radio station. I use doctors, 877, and nurses and physician's assistants, 877-301-8970. Is this something that has appeal to you? Putting aside just for a second the equity or inequity issue, who can afford this would not do this. The convenience is epic. And also, you don't have to sit in the doctor's office, everybody looking at you, trying to figure out why are you there to begin with. I think this is a brilliant extension. What do they call it? Uber for doctors, which is really what it is.
You know, when you mentioned the outpatient clinic, I should have thought, too, there are those minute clinics now that are at CVS.
Where I don't even mean those, but sure.
You go get a lot of things there that you would normally have to wait to go to the emergency room for. So there is some inroads on this whole kind of thing. But I'm telling you, you think about it, $199 is a lot of money, but not if you're in a really bad place.
Of course, obviously.
I like the idea that you have this option there. I really like the idea of the physician actually coming to your house. Of course, you need to be worried to make sure it was a real physician and not some, you know, weirdo.
Yeah, and let me tell you, the key is when the physician arrives at your door and they have a pepperoni pizza too, then you should at least ask to see their credentials.
Yeah, that's right. That could be another. I didn't think of that. The security angle on this whole thing.
877-301-8970. It's called Pager. That's the system. And again, they exist in New York City. They're available in Manhattan and Brooklyn from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. And they are apparently imminently on their way here.
Dave from Waltham. What do you think about this, Dave?
Hey, Dave.
I think you should be allowed to buy what you want to, regardless whether it's healthcare or not. If you tell people they cannot buy something, they're going to go somewhere else and get it. For one thing, they'll be boutiqued in Mexico and Canada then, or something that will serve this. But the idea that you can actually limit what somebody can decide to purchase for their own health is just terribly
well, let me be clear, Dave. If I left that impression that I misspoke, I'm not suggesting that it should be outlawed by some regulatory governing body. I'm saying if it's here, and obviously it is in New York, and it's on its way to Boston, and obviously if it exists and it isn't violating any laws, people can use it if they choose. I was just commenting on the inequity of the thing. Of course, if you want to purchase it, just like those, what are they called again? Concierge. Doctors. You can
boutique
do that.
Medicine.
You can do that kind of thing, too.
The inequity question is much larger than this.
Oh, of course it is.
Question, but yeah.
It is.
I just thought I'd pipe in there. And it actually worries me quite a bit that anybody would ever think to cap my ability to care for myself.
Well, but we do already. I mean, you can't buy an organ if you're a zillionaire.
That's a good point.
If you need you have to be on the list. And
not in this country.
Meaning you could buy one and another. You make a very good point, Dave.
In this country, you cannot do it.
Well, stay there, Dave. Is your view, because you said a minute ago and you just said again, that you can go to another country and get the care, and in this case, go to another country and buy an organ because you have more money than the next guy. Should it be the same way here, that if you're willing to pay a higher price, even if you'd be lower on the list, that you or Jane Doe could outbid you and she gets the organ before you do?
That adds a wrinkle. Uber for organs, huh?
Goodbye, Dave. Thank you for the call. We appreciate
Although
it.
Although I should say there are a lot of people that have been suspicious when people that had liver problems. What do you get if you take too many drugs? Is it a liver problem or a kidney problem? The people that have had long-term problems with drugs and then seem to be going to the front of the list for some of these organ transplants if they're famous. But
Some manipulation, but that's...
I don't know if those are false accusations or if they are...
But for the most part, you have to wait your turn is the bottom line, unless there's some extraordinary circumstance.
Let's go to Steve in the car. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Steve.
Hi. Yeah, I think that this is... it's a great app, and I don't really understand in life why people don't want to come to the grips with the fact that when you go to the doctor, you're entering into commercial transactions. So why can't a doctor have the freedom to charge for his services? And by trying to make everybody equal in poverty, you know, you're depriving everybody of the freedom that the Constitution guarantees, especially to a doctor.
Stevie, this is a horrible connection, so we got to let you go, not because of your point of view, but because you kept breaking up. But the problem is we have a primary care doctor shortage in Massachusetts and in much of the country to begin with. Would you not agree? Well, Marjorie now will be in place of Steve. This creates a greater primary care physician problem because, again, a lot of, I assume, young doctors, for the most part, are going to be diverted away from a traditional practice into the $200 or $300 for a visit to your house, no?
Well, yeah, but, I mean, I think Colin's making the point that if you don't have a lot of money, you're not going to go to, Grill 23 for your dinner because you don't have the money to do it.
Do you want a steak dinner and medical care to be treated the same way?
No,
you don't have
a
right to a steak dinner. A lot of people think, I'm not arguing constitutionally, but a lot of people think health care should be a right, which is sort of the premise behind the Massachusetts plan and the Affordable Care Act.
They may think it, but we don't have it.
We don't have a constitutional right.
I think the problem with you, Jim, is you're feeling a little guilty. You know, you come from Cambridge and, you know, all
because they already signed up for the app. If I could, I would. No, first of all, I'm admitting my hypocrisy. This is so up my angle. The only thing that would be better if they have portable MRIs. If they could just wheel that baby right into your house, stick you into that thing, and, you know, I mean, that's...
Is that radiation you get in an MRI?
Some sort of
aren't
radiation.
Aren't you worried that you're going to be, like, glowing in the studio someday?
If I were, it's long past time to worry. What did Art Kaplan refer to me as amongst the worried well?
Worried well. That
well,
is
I am
correct.
A worried well. I like to take care of myself. Let's go to Mark in Lexington.
Hi, Mark.
You're on the Jim and Marjorie in Boston Public Radio. Hi there.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
I've had something like this app for a number of years.
What's that?
Called MDVIP.
Oh, what is it?
And my doctor in Brookline, a few years ago, he got sick. Are the insurance companies telling him he had like 90 seconds per patient and needed to see 3 million patients a year?
Right.
So he joined this group. It's a nationwide group where they guarantee to only take X amount of patients. They guarantee to always have availability to see you every day. And when you go in, they not only know you personally, but if you need 5 minutes or 30 minutes or 2 hours, however much time you need with them, they have that much time for you.
That's like the concierge thing I was describing a minute ago, this concierge practice where you pay a certain fee and you're admitted to the club, essentially.
Yeah, and in a sense, this is what this is you're paying extra every year.
How much?
To pay about $1,500 a year.
Extra.
Yeah, and you're doing that to get the kind of relationship that you've always wanted to have with your doctor. That there's no way you can get otherwise.
And once you've paid the $1,500, Mark, are all the other fees the same as they'd be if you didn't belong to the concierge service, meaning are they ones that'd be reimbursed by insurance or no?
Yeah, everything else is exactly the same. Now, I travel a lot for my business, mm-hmm. and since this network is nationwide, no matter where I am in the country, if I need to go see a doctor, they're like, oh, sure, come in right now. We have space.
But you know what I don't understand? If your insurance still covers a lot of your care and you're paying the extra $1,500 a year, isn't the doctor under the same sort of stresses from the insurance company still?
No, because what they're as part of the MDVIP service, they are restricted to only having X number of patients per year.
Yeah.
And so their schedules never get overcrowded. So basically, what they lose from the insurance companies,
they make up with the $1,500.
Okay,
they make
I
up
got you.
Fee.
Mark, thank you for sharing that with us. We appreciate it.
Here's an email from Scott in New Bedford. He says, "Boutique medicine is a symptom of the problem. Fix the problem. It's just like parking in Boston. Boston needs to invest in proper parking. Massachusetts needs to invest in MDs. Medicine, like homes, shouldn't be big business."
That is, I thought, perfect. Do you not? I mean,
I
that's
think
pretty perfect.
You and Scott can go have an MRI together. Let's go to John in Hyannis. Hi, John.
Hello, John.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Listen, why do we need to have doctors do house calls for $300? Why not nurses for $50 or nurse practitioners for $100?
I agree with you.
That's a great idea.
I mean, we overuse doctors in our healthcare system, which drives the price of everything up. But that's the way we think. We can't help it. We think doctors have all the answers, and that's not true.
By the way, the alternative, it's not all, they're not alternative. Physician's assistants, nurse practitioners, all these people, you're right. I mean, one, it's at lower cost, and two, the competency level is really high. Also, all these surveys, I'm a big fan of people in the medical trade, I should say, from top to bottom. But if you ever see these surveys of patients, the ratings of nurses and people like them are always much higher from the patient than they are from at least the generic class of doctors.
But then there's
John, thanks for the call.
The restrictions on what nurses can and can't do.
So that, but that's expanding a bit too. I mean, if these minute clinics, you can go to CVS and, as you say, or Walgreens and have a lot of stuff done that you can't imagine. I know a lot of people are doing this, but is there not some psychological barrier you have to get over to all of a sudden be doing, for example, at Walgreens, what they told me the other day is, I'm serious. They told me, did you get your flu shots? And I said, yeah, I did. They said, did your kids get their flu shots? You know what they offer you? If you buy a flu shot from them, they will donate a flu shot in some third world country.
So oh, wow.
I mean, so
were you at the Minute Clinic in Walgreens?
No, I happened to be at the pharmacy, if you really feel the need to know. But no, and I'm fairly friendly with lead pharmacists.
I bet you are.
I'm very friendly. We're on speaking terms, first name basis.
Okay.
And all that kind of thing. But the thing is called Pager. And what is it called? GetPager.com? Is that the website, Amanda? Yes, it is. GetPager.com if you want to check out this thing. Apparently, it's on its way to Boston.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm sorry we didn't get to the rest of the calls and the emails, but we are out of time. But thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please tune in tomorrow. Ask the Governor with Deval Patrick is here. We're also going to be joined by gubernatorial candidate Republican Charlie Baker. That's great because Charlie Baker and Governor Patrick Ranigan did the last time around.
Yes, they did.
They're both going to be here tomorrow. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Mers, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan. Our engineer is Alan Mattis. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy. And by the way, I am doing three debates in three nights. Tonight, it's the two Democrats for Attorney General, Maura Healey and Warren Tolman. That's 6 o'clock on NECN, and if you can't get near a TV, it will be simulcast on WGBH Radio.
Three debates this week.
Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
You are an iron man, Jim.
I really am.
Thanks for listening. Please listen again tomorrow.